The year that this week's album was released, movie tickets cost only a dollar. You could have watched Cary Grant hang off of the side of George Washington's face, Charlton Heston run over stuntmen with a chariot for 45 minutes, or whatever Bela Lugosi did in Plan 9 from Outer Space. That was long before Soundgarden wrote that one song. This week's artist was known as the Angry Man of Jazz. He didn't earn this moniker through tweets, the internet was at least 24 years away, but rather punching trombonist Jimmy Nepper in the mouth, destroying a tooth and Nepper's uppermost octave in one fell swoop. They say art is pain. Maybe they is Jimmy Nepper. The second track on this week's album was covered by none other than rock guitar god and personal hero Jeff Beck, and is a tribute to jazz saxophonist Lester Young. I heard the cover before the original, but I like them both equally, I have to say. What year was it? It was 1959. And who is the artist this week? None other than Charles Mingus. This week's album is Mingus's masterpiece, say that five times fast, Mingus Today on Two Dudes and Tunes. You're listening to Two Dudes and Tunes, the podcast wherein two dudes, myself and Wood Johnson, talk tunes. In this case, they're all tunes by Charles Mingus. But before we dive into this dense and fascinating work, let's check in with Wood. Wood, how you doing?
I am doing exceedingly stupendously swell, my friend. How about you?
That sounds like you're doing pretty good. Well, I'm doing great. Like I said, last week, Megan and I finally closed on our house. Now it's time to start doing stuff. I got in over the weekend and worked on cleaning up our garage because our garage was a disaster. But now it is an organized disaster, which is far superior than just regular old disaster.
How close were you to being on an episode of Hoarders?
Oh, we haven't had the house long enough. But I tell you what, give it a year. And you would have seen my dumb mug on there going like, oh, but I don't know. We might need these like picture hanging screws for something. I'm sure they'll be important later.
Oh, man, I know the feeling. Trust me. We've owned this house for right at 5 years right now. And it just seems like we always find another place to put things. And I don't know. I try not to be sentimental about it, but I already had to buy it once. What do you mean I might have to buy it again?
Yeah, yep, exactly. That's exactly right. Megan was looking through my toolbox for something the other day, and she was like, you just have so much junk in there. I was like, yeah, but wait, what if I...
Wait, you had a toolbox, but last week you didn't have pliers to turn off your washer.
Like Megan said, we have a lot of junk in that toolbox. And it turns out that a U.S. Army standard multi-tool will not fix everything. It can fix a lot, but can't fix everything.
Neither can alcohol, but you know.
And yet we drink. Well, how are you doing? You said you were exceedingly stupendously swell.
It's a callback to a friend of mine who listened to one of our episodes recently, and he used to do a lot of stand-up stage theater type stuff, and that was how his character walked on stage every week. When they asked him how he was doing, that was his line, and he did kind of he had these motions that he did with it, including ending with the karate crane from Karate Kid.
Oh, man, I love it. So, I love it.
But anyhow, if he's listening, he'll know exactly where that came from. No, I mean... So last week I talked about being back at work and getting in the saddle. One of the things I didn't mention was my first day back. I kind of got to experience both the highs and lows of managing people. So when I left out on vacation a couple of weeks ago, there was an investigation going into one of my employees, and I kind of knew what the outcome was going to be from that investigation. And so my first order of business when I got back to work last week was to, unfortunately let that person go for cause. And it really kind of stinks because I thought he was a really good person. And
oh man,
turns out he'd kind of been stealing from us for a while. And that just really sucks. But on the flip side of that, I also got to promote a different person for a different role the same afternoon. So I went from that conversation to promoting a guy in another city from a craft worker for us to a supervisor. And so I was riding both waves, if you would call it that way.
Yeah. You're not supposed to mix your uppers and your downers. And this is not the first time I've had to tell you this. Yes, exactly. That's a joke that I've recycled.
No, you know, for me, kind of my career model as a supervisor is to get people where they want to go. And, you know, build people into the, you know, the kind of employees and give them the opportunities they need to be successful and show their potential. And sometimes you hit a home run and like Babe Ruth, a lot of the time you strike out. So unfortunately I'm batting 50 as of that day.
Hey, batting 50 is pretty good. You know what the thing is?
No, it's like, phenomenal. Who has ever batted 50? Hold up.
Yeah, watch yourself. Absolutely. No one has. But you know, you can't, as I have learned, like you can do everything in the world to train a new guy. And if they make bad decisions, mm-hmm. like that's on them. We had, I'm going to distract with this tangent real quick. We had one guy, that I trained, and he was a real loud, kind of boisterous dude. And he was a lot of fun at first. Mm-hmm. And then after his, the probationary period where he works for the temp agency until he gets hired on full time, he got hired on full time, and we discovered that he was not the shining light that I was hoping he would be. Because for one thing, he was the kind of dude who would walk away from you as if he couldn't hear you. If you like needed his help with something and like called across to him from, from like across the yard, like, "Hey, I need you to help me out with something." He would just keep walking like, "Oh no, I didn't hear that." But he kept missing Mondays. And he would miss and he would miss and he would miss. And so finally he came in one Tuesday after having missed the entire day Monday, and they fired him. Mm-hmm. Another coworker was getting his truck worked on at a mechanic and saw this former employee's car sitting in the driveway of the mechanic or whatever. And so this guy asked him, like, "Hey, what's that dude's deal? Like, what does he do?" And this guy had been driving to Colorado to buy weed over the weekend and make the drive back, and was just too tired to show up to work because he had been up all night driving this weed so that he could sell it here in Texas.
Not only was he late for work on Mondays, he was trafficking narcotics. Got it.
Yes. And look, I don't want to get into the like legalization debate, but for my own personal convenience, legalize it so that we don't have another Nimrod who decides that he needs a full-time job where I work, but he also wants to traffic in narcotics.
Hey, he peddles in internet and interstate felonies, whatever.
Yeah.
Well, in the case of the two guys that I was dealing with, I mean, one of them, the one that we let go of, had been with us for about 11 years. And so it was really kind of sad. He was one of those rock star people that I thought was really, really great. And the story of the guy that we promoted, his story is just so cool. He was a mechanic for us, and he had some health issues and ended up losing a lung. And so he could no longer work as a mechanic. And so he tendered his resignation to us about 5 years ago and said, "I can't work as a mechanic. I can't be outside." And instead of letting him go, we asked, "Do you want to keep working? We can find a job for you in the office." And he had never mm-hmm. worked in an office before. He'd been a mechanic for 35 years out in the shop. And he said, "I would love to work in the office, but I don't know how to answer phones. I don't know how to talk to people." And like, that was his legit, like, "We can't do that. I can't do that. I don't know how to do it." Yeah. We said, "Well, let's bring you in. Let's see if you're trainable. Let's try it out." And he became one of our best administrators. So he worked our front office for about 5 years. And
that is fantastic.
About a month ago, I asked him, what do you think about, you know, we'd had this management position open for about 3 months, and the people who were applying really weren't qualified or weren't really up to the kind of level of service that we need out of them. And so I went over to Houston where he's working in our shop and said, hey, man, I really like your telephone presence. I like how good you are with our clients. Would you consider this management job? Not only would it be a pay raise, it'd be more, you know, responsibility and more authority to kind of get things done. Is that something you're interested in? And he approached it the same way he did with moving into the office. I don't know if I'm ready for that. I've never done that, whatever.
Yeah.
He's been in that job for right at a week now, and he is so good at it. Like, he's found his niche and he already knows everything. Like, I'm so excited for him.
That's so great. That's got to be really satisfying to be able to help people kind of achieve on that level.
It made up for just how terrible I felt after the earlier in the morning. Because, of course, the first thing in the morning was, let's get the bad news out of the way.
Oh, yeah. You got to rip that bandaid off. You don't want to milk somebody for a full day's work and then, like, Oh, by the way,
here's the overmounting, overwhelming evidence against you.
Yeah.
You know, get off my property. But
anyhow, oh, man, rough.
We've cycled about the woes of managing people for long enough. You got anything else new, or do we want to get into Charles Mingus's music?
Tell you what, let's get into the album this week, because I've been excited about it all day.
Mingus Ah 1959, October of 1959, to be precise. Chris, tell me a little bit about why this album is on your list and why it means so much to you.
So this album, like a lot of the albums on our list, probably came out of my time in San Antonio. One of the very first things I think we just discovered as a family when we moved there. Dad got stationed at Fort Sam, so we moved there. We discovered that San Antonio has maybe the best jazz radio station I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. And I'm really hoping you're not about to tell me that they're not around, because we loved 91.7 KRTU Trinity University.
When I first read your show notes about this, I thought you were mistaken in talking about 90.1 KYSM, which is San Antonio College's radio station across the street from Trinity.
No, I do love the San Antonio College radio station, because it's like janky indie music all the time.
It's so weird.
I love it. I love listening occasionally to the tech radio station here in town, but 91.7 is really just about the best jazz radio station I've ever heard. Dad listened to it a ton. And so I just picked up the habit, and I'm pretty sure that I heard at least two or three of the tracks from today's album on that radio station. And that's what got me into it. And then the other track that kind of made its way into my consciousness sort of like tangentially was the song Goodbye Pork Pie Hat, which I mentioned in the show intro, is a tune that Jeff Beck covered. And I meant to send you a link to the cover, and I'm sad I didn't, because Jeff Beck is a really expressive guitarist. He's very lyrical, and their take on it is kind of a little bit more contemporary sort of noir movie kind of take on it. Like all the best stuff about Eric Clapton's playing on the Die Hard. What was the, I'm getting too old for this stuff.
Lethal Weapon, the greatest four movies ever made. Best buddy cop movie ever.
Yeah. So like it reminds me a little bit of that, as far as just like really cool guitar playing. But anyway, that's Jeff Beck covering this Charles Mingus tune. And so I think the first time I heard the album as a whole was on the now defunct music app Rhapsody. that eventually became Napster, and I think Napster has since like gone under, because there was a time where Napster went legit and they were a music service, and then I think they folded. I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure it's still around, but it's like the bloated corpse of what it once was.
Yeah.
Not kinda to be like too MySpace.
MySpace is still, you can still go to MySpace, but why would you want
why
to?
Why would you bother? Yeah.
Yeah, well, exactly.
To assuage your fears, KRTU, Trinity University, is still on the air and they live stream. So it's been on air since the 80s. So,
well, I need to live stream some of that while I'm at work, kind of get my jazz fix. Nice. But that was my history with it. What about you? Is this new for you, or have you heard any of this? What's the deal?
So I've heard a couple of tracks from this as it was featured in other things over the years. But as far as knowing, oh yeah, that's Charles Mingus, and you know, here's what his contributions to the musical lexicon of, you know, American or Americana and jazz are, I would not have been able to have connect those dots, you know, even as of last week. So I would say I've been tangentially aware of his work, not even knowing who he was or, you know, what it was. But I did find a lot of it to be fun and a lot of it to be intriguing. There were some bits of it that I struggled with a little bit, and it's hard for me to kind of put that into words. Just kind of, you know, we've talked about this before. I have no formal musical training, and I kind of missed out on kind of the jazz train in high school. You know, I didn't play in a band or anything like that. And so while everybody like you was out there, you know, getting into, you know, jazz band or whatever in eighth and ninth grade, I was off doing something stupid other than that. And I'm so fresh and new to jazz as a genre that I don't really kind of know how to put it into words in a way that I think is less insulting to people who know about it.
I am not going to take anything personally. So you don't need to worry about that.
There are a lot of things I love about this album, though. There are a lot of things, you know, this is going to be well reviewed by me. I'll just go ahead and say that. I enjoyed this album. I ended up kind of stuck in a rabbit hole of just Charles Mingus Jr. in general, though. So when I was listening to this, I kept being drawn back to who is this guy? And so I feel like a lot of my notes are going to kind of color what I've read about him just in the last week since we've had this. But that's kind of where I'm coming from, at least.
Yeah, it's interesting. Jazz, I feel like, it's been referred to as like American classical music. And I really think that American music education really ought to, I mean, there are a lot of things that we ought to do right. Because there are some practices that we have when we teach children music that don't enable them to actually get a career in music, because it's practices that are long outdated. But jazz has a lot of connections to modern music. Whether you're looking at pop or, you know, something more obscure, jazz has leaked into rock and every other art form, rap, for instance. And so I think it's a shame that it's not part of the education of, you know, public school students musically, because like this album is just super rich. We've talked a lot about things being accessible and kind of the push and pull between music being challenging and music being accessible. And so to just kind of shift into talking about this album as a whole, this was really the first time that I had listened to the entire album with a more critical ear. I listened to it a lot to hear the tracks that I was familiar with. The songs that I had kind of heard already were some of the stuff from the front end of the album, Better Get It In Your Soul and Boogie Stop Shuffle, Goodbye Pork Pie Hat. But, you know, the structure of this album, I think, is interesting because it almost kind of lulls you in to a false sense of security. Like, okay, this is like familiar territory. None of these harmonies are really out there. You know, it starts with Better Get It In Your Soul, which I'm pretty positive that's the one that I remembered the most hearing on the radio, because it's got this great kind of rollicking like horn part in it. And I'm not sure who it is, but there's somebody in the background. It might be Charles Mingus. I don't know. But having these kind of like vocal outbursts of like gospel energy. And that was an homage to the gospel tradition that Charles Mingus grew up in. And so it starts with this Better Get It In Your Soul. You're like, okay, this is like familiar to me. Goodbye Pork Pie Hat, which sounds kind of like a noir film. You know, it's this really like kind of moody, emotional ballad. And then Boogie Stop Shuffle, which is like a blues. It's structured like a blues tune. It's a little mischievous. And then things immediately kind of get interesting. And so I'm curious, what was your experience? Like, how did you feel about some of the really like dissonant, off-kilter harmonies and stuff? Like what was your emotional reaction to some of this music?
So having no formal music training, it's kind of hard for me to say, oh, well, I didn't like this because it has a dissonant harmony. But there are certain tracks for me that weren't operating on a level that I felt was familiar enough to be like, oh, yeah, I really like this. A perfect example of that is actually, and I'm so dumb. Like, let's just go ahead and get this out of there. I did not realize until I started reading about it and you started just throwing stuff at me. The string in our text messages was full of videos over the last couple of days. I didn't realize that this is kind of a homage to so many different influences that he had over his life. And so when I listened to Open Letter to Duke originally, that was one of those tracks that just seemed all over the place.
Now, like, where is this going?
Exactly. And it was kind of not off-putting, but it was uneasy feeling because I didn't feel comfortable in what it was doing or where it was going.
Yeah.
Until you sent me, you know, the clip of Duke Ellington playing, it's like, oh, I see what's happening here. I get it. Like, this kind of fits together. But for being like that uninitiated kind of outside the fold looking in kind of thing, it was kind of weird. And I found that kind of interesting when I was reading a little bit about Mingus growing up and the fact that he had trouble getting into orchestra as a kid because he couldn't read music the way, you know, the other kids were able to read music. And so a lot of his musical influences early on, at least, he characterized himself as being an outsider looking in. And I felt like, hey, I'm an outsider looking in on this album. So I get where you are now. So that was kind of cool.
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't know anything about that until I started doing research for the show notes for the album. And for me, I found it illuminating just because it kind of gave me like a mental framework to work off of, because especially the center of this album, I think, is really dense. There are a lot of harmonies that are not kind of the traditional harmonies you think of. Even a lot of music released. So we were talking about this off mic. 1959 was an incredible year for jazz. And it was kind of a mix of people doing more traditional sounding records that have probably got a wider following. Dave Brubeck released Time Out, which has the song Take Five on it, which I'm sure that you've heard and would recognize if I like pulled up a little clip of it and played it for you. But Dave Brubeck, the Dave Brubeck Quartet, him and Paul Desmond are very, their sense of harmony is a lot more melodious the improvisations that they come up with, the songs that Dave Brubeck is writing are going to be a lot more familiar to your ears. They're not kind of pushing the boundaries of like what notes are we going to play over what chords. Same thing with Miles Davis releasing Kind of Blue that year. This is all stuff that you would hear and your ears would automatically kind of click into, okay, this is, you know, you're jamming on this chord progression and I can kind of follow it. This album is interesting because it's music that's like that, but strained through this kind of new post-bop lens. I think as you, if you're looking at jazz history, this chunk of time, the farther you get away from the 30s and 40s big band music, the music of Duke Ellington, the more people are just trying to say like, okay, how far can we take this? Like, how out there musically can we get? And so it was fun to me to learn this week that Mingus was looking at all these influences and saying like, okay, well, I love these things. How can I reinterpret them in this new and modern way? And so the reason I kind of assaulted you with a bunch of YouTube videos was so that at least you would have some frame of reference, because I didn't until like a couple days ago. Mm-hmm. And it helped me click and go like, oh, okay, that's why this sounds the way it does, is because if you like listen really carefully, you can kind of hear some of those things in it. And it's one of the things that I didn't realize until doing research that I really love about it. Mm-hmm. Is how this is his kind of send up of a lot of his influences.
Yeah. And I want to take a moment and talk, and I feel like I get focused on this way too often, but the production quality of this album, we, as a society, we have a what's old is broke, not necessarily it can be good and old or whatever. And this album, I don't know when it was remastered or whatever. I'm sure it has been endless numbers of times, but
yeah,
it is just so clean and open and free sounding. It almost sounds like it could have been recorded 10 years ago, not 70. So, or it's not been 70, but 60 years ago for sure at this point. So hats off to, you know, whoever was producing this recording, being able to get something that has stood the test of time so that we can appreciate it today. Because without that, if it sounded old, and not old for the sake of sounding old, just if it sounded old, I don't think it would have the staying power that it has right now.
Yeah, it is something that I think is remarkable about a lot of the body of like what we consider canon in jazz. You get to a certain point with, I would say probably with bop and like West Coast jazz and a lot of this kind of stuff, it's all produced remarkably well. Mm-hmm. And the producer for this album was Atio Joseph Teo, that's his nickname, Macero. He worked for Columbia Records, and he's produced quite a bit of things. Actually, he's produced some stuff that we've mentioned on the show before. He produced Miles Davis' Bitches Brew, which is interesting because that's like way out there in left field kind of weirdness. But he produced Dave Brubeck's Time Out, which is similarly just like from the aesthetics of the recording, just super pleasing. Everything is real crisp and clear. Everybody's, you know, it helps that everybody is performing together, right? We're not dubbing tracks in. But he also produced, let's see, according to Wikipedia, although the extent of his role has been disputed, he has also been associated with the production of Miles Davis's 1959 album, Kind of Blue, which is jazz's best-selling record. And so this is a guy that I think has just worked with a lot of professionals, and you can't help but accrue a kind of genius hand with that kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know, working with people like that. But I do love, I think that's one of the things that appeals to me in general, is a lot of jazz is just produced with this ear towards the purity of capturing the performance and the attempt to get the ensemble mm-hmm. to be captured in a way that is like compelling and concise.
Well, and I liked, and I know this is probably an unfair comparison, comparing this to the Herbie Hancock album we did recently, Headhunters, yeah. I liked how unexperimental this seemed from the production side of the house. It's very yeah. improvisational, but it's very mm-hmm. traditional in its instrumentation and how it's delivered, even if they're doing some very unique things with harmonies and melodies and playing off of each other. It's not some random brand new synthesizer in there. And I get it's 1959. I mean, we hadn't even put yeah. a man in orbit yet, but there is something about it that is so traditionally comforting when it is so new musically, or while it still is so new musically.
Yeah, it's something that I love about jazz in general, and this album in particular, is that the emphasis is not on the technology, mm-hmm. is not on what is the new thing we can do with the instrument. The idea is, what is the new thing that we can create? Mm-hmm. What is the idea that we can express that is new and exciting? The word that I kept thinking of with this album is adventurous. This album is super adventurous because, you know, like we mentioned earlier, these are all a ton of staples in jazz music that that Mingus is paying homage to. Hold on just a second, my dog is bothering the hell out of me.
5 hours later.
So, you know, I mentioned Better Get It in Your Soul. That was his homage to gospel music. Goodbye Pork Pie Hat, as I mentioned in the intro, was an homage to Lester Young, who was a prominent saxophonist who passed away before Mingus started recording this album. Boogie Stop Shuffle, although it has kind of a mischievous sort of bent to it, is basically structured like a blues tune. Open Letter to Duke, as we talked about, was for Duke Ellington. The tune Jelly Roll is an homage to Jelly Roll Morton. So he's taking all these familiar things and kind of flipping them on their head a little bit in this post-bop way. It's all about the ideas and not about the technology. And so I think that really is something that is exciting to me about this album. You know, he plays with kind of just the fundamental things about music that you think of. You think of the harmonies and the rhythms. Harmonically, he has some crazy experiments. Bird Calls, Self-Portrait in Three Colors, and Boogie Stop Shuffle are some really like challenging harmonies. So he's playing with just the basic building blocks of music on this album, the basic, like the fundamental tenets of jazz. And he's trying to push these things in an interesting direction. You were saying, I kind of want to take a little bit of a right turn here. You were saying that you were captivated by Charles Mingus, the person. And so I'm curious, what was it that was so interesting about him? Because he is a pretty interesting character.
Well, I mean, first off, you can tell a lot about the character of a person by the number of times they're married. Charles Mingus was married 5 times in his 59 year lifespan. On top of that, while he was still kind of in his prime, I mean, he's one of those musicians who was really popular in his time, which, I mean, it's music. We shouldn't be surprised by that looking on it. But he wrote an autobiography about it, you know, about himself, Wood. and in it, he claimed to have been married to 2 of the women at the same time. So he seems to be universally revered as just a superbly brilliant mind, almost like a, I don't know, I'm at a loss for words about it, but just somebody at the very forefront, the zeitgeist of everything going on in jazz music. And he kind of seems like he was a jerk to work with in a lot of ways. I think he was. I mean, you were listing all the different people he worked with over the years and his jazz workshop group and the fact that it was just always kind of turning over new talent. But I feel like a lot of that had to do with just him being kind of a demanding, you know, pain in the butt to work with. And there were a bunch of different excerpts that I read about him, you know, kicking people out of events or, you know, firing his band in the middle of a show because they weren't being improvisational enough or exploring the full space of what he intended for something to happen. And, you know, calling them back like an hour later when he'd calmed down or whatever. It just seemed like, it's not that that comes through in this recording. I don't think it does. But I kept being drawn into what was it about this person that kept people coming back to him other than his music? Because he had a pretty magnetic personality, it seems like.
Yeah, it's interesting. We tend to celebrate difficult people. And I think that we sometimes miss out on the fact that a lot of these difficult people had pretty short lives. I forget what it is that Mingus was afflicted with.
ALS.
ALS, is that a genetic thing?
Yeah, so it's also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, but eventually, you know, basically your body shutting down system by system over years. It's a nervous system disease.
So he is kind of the odd man out, I feel like, with jazz, because I mean, this is probably a stereotype, but there were a lot of prominent jazz musicians who got into drugs and died. But I think art in general attracts some really fiery personalities. But I think we lose track of the fact that the people who go along to get along and are also really talented have the most success, if you want to call it that. But man, it does really make for some interesting stories. I was blown away that he destroyed a $20,000 bass on stage.
Over people talking.
Which, you know, I'm all for consuming art for art's sake. But when you look at the context of jazz, like a lot of jazz was performed to dance to or as background music. Now, consequently, the people performing that music, some of them were geniuses and created some of the most amazing music ever. But like, come on, Mingus, read the room. Like you're being hired to play in front of people who are eating and drinking. Like that is just craziness to me.
Well, I thought it was interesting going back to his genius for a moment. So, you know, he broke that $20,000 bass. Reading through some of the other works that he'd worked on, I mean, he has an album of him playing classical piano and he has an album of him playing guitar. And I mean, talk about being a polymath of your, you know, your field of study. Like he was all over the place. And the fact that he was able to record something and be successful across so many different instruments where it was him just focusing on it, like just a solo piano album. Here we go. And he was able to be successful at that given all the challenges he had early on in life. One thing we didn't mention a little bit earlier when he was a young kid, his mom would only let him listen to church music. And so here's this kid who, you know, short of hearing gospel music, was learning to play music kind of in a box, if you will. And it wasn't until he got involved in, you know, his early teen years that he was able to really learn about all the other things that music has to offer. And he turned it into this.
Yeah. And you had brought up earlier, you know, why, what is it about him that made people keep working with him? The guy that I mentioned at the top of the show, Jimmy Nepper, played trombone on this album. Mm-hmm. And I didn't read whether it was before or after he got punched in the face.
He came right back.
So that's
Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah. Well, I think part of what made Mingus alluring was his identity as a composer. Mm-hmm. You know, jazz is all about improvisation. We kind of talked about that a little bit in the Herbie Hancock album, but a lot of musicians, would set up just like a loose framework of this is the A section, this is the B section. We'll take turns playing that. You get to play solos over these chords. You get to play solos over these. There's
structure kind of, in the chaos.
Yeah, exactly. It's organized chaos. But Mingus, I think, was really interested in what can we achieve compositionally, and that is a thing that he was doing when jazz had already moved on from that. Mm-hmm. Somebody like Duke Ellington or Benny Goodman, and these guys worked with arrangers, of course. They would come up with these songs and then work with an arranger to give people parts and stuff. But these are guys composing pieces in what we would think of as like a more classical style. Mm-hmm. And so here you have Charles Mingus, whose brain I think is oriented to work that way. He's got room for improvisations on this album, but they're short. They're not nearly as long as something Miles Davis or John Coltrane would do. But the genius I think is in the moments that he creates where everybody is kind of working in concert to express this idea that he's come up with. And so if I had to guess, I would guess that it was just his novel approach that made people go, like, yeah, he busted me in the chops and kicked me out of a rehearsal for an hour while like him and the rhythm section played blues. But like the guy has something intriguing to say. I don't think that's an excuse for being bad to people, but I think it does give a window into what made him different.
It's the Steve Jobs effect just in music 50 years before.
Yeah. And the result is has brought me a lot more joy than having to fuss with my iPhone when I need to like buy more storage or what have you.
Yeah, I get it. I did want to talk a little bit about the compositional genius of Mingus. In doing my research on him, I learned that in 1963, he did have a flop of a recording. He had gone on a string of just huge success, and then in 63, a couple years after this, he attempted to record a live album called Epitaph, which is a 4,235 measure recording that takes more than 2 hours to perform live. And he attempted to record it, and he claimed, you know, up and down, that it was supposed to be just an open practice session where people could come listen to him and a 30-piece band practice this thing, that it wasn't ready. But studios turned it into a recording session and billed it as a live concert, and it fell apart all over itself. It wasn't properly amplified. There was all sorts of problems. The music wasn't ready.
Oh, wow.
He has a quote that in the middle of this concert, he got up, grabbed a microphone that had no amplification, and said, "Get your money back. I couldn't stop you from coming here. The press lied to you. You're being taken advantage of. Get out now. Get your money back. I don't want you to think that I've done this to you. It was supposed to be a recording session, but George Ween, who's a fine promoter, changed it into a concert. Get your money back. This company has lots of money. It would take years to rehearse this music." And then Then this composition died. It went nowhere. And it wasn't until about 10 years after Mingus died that it was found again. And it was actually recorded and done right in the late 80s. And so it's one of those things that I'm interested in checking out after we're done with this recording. Mainly because it's 100% composed. There is no improvisation in it. So
see
what he has to offer on that front.
You have intrigued me to no end.
It intrigued me too. It was a lot of those things. I was like, oh shoot, I really want to know about this, because he buried it. He never talked about it again after that night.
Yeah, well, and it wasn't in any of the, you know, you look up lists of like his prominent works, it doesn't even really show up that I noticed.
The only recording of it I have found available, and I mean, it's 147 minutes long, is on the NPR website. It's not available on Spotify or Apple Music. NPR broadcast it in 1990, and it's available to stream from there. So I'm going to give it a try.
Man, I am a sucker for stuff like that, hidden works and things. Yeah, I'm sure that you know about this, but that makes me think of how Stanley Kubrick was going to do a Napoleon movie and spent years and years creating costumes and trying to come up with ways to capture thousands and thousands of soldiers on screen. That kind of genius is just exciting. And it's fun when you have an album like this one where you actually get to, you know, it's come to fruition. It's not like the missing link that I have to like go to NPR to listen to. He's a captivating figure for sure. I wanted to bring up, so the name of this album, I didn't know anything about. I just thought it was just like kind of a, you know, like was just like an expression or something, you know, just some kind of jazz, like scat or a vocalization or something.
I did know this before, so.
Did you? Oh, man. I mean, I'm not surprised.
The only thing I knew about this album was the title, but go ahead.
But it was so fascinating to me. So the album's title is a play on the Latin word Magnus. So Mingus Magnus. What Charles Mingus is doing here is conjugating his last name through all the different genders that Latin words go through. So Mingus, us is the masculine ending of a word. Ah, or just like the letter A, but ah is the feminine, and U-M is the neuter. So he's kind of saying like, I'm the greatest in every way possible, you know. But something interesting, a spin on that that I read. So I read, I just Googled Mingus like title, comma, Latin or something. I don't even remember what I Googled. But the New England Review, which is some kind of online publication, or maybe they're more prominent than that. I don't know. Please don't at me. This writer, Ian Genasi, for the New England Review, was bringing up the fact that, and I've never taken a day of Latin in my life. So once again, don't at me. But Mingere or Mingere, M-I-N-G-E-R-E, means to urinate. And so if you apply those like conjugation rules to Mingus, you kind of come up with a transliteration that means pissy, pardon my language, which is an adjective that Mingus probably knew described himself pretty well. So it's just this really like this really kind of clever, educated joke that he's telling with the title of this album. And it kind of, to me, that sort of sums up the experience I had with it, is there was always something a little deeper and richer to dig into musically than what you first expect upon hearing this record.
So based on that deep dive of, you know, the title structure of this album, what does that mean about his 1964 album, Mingus, 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 Mingus?
I think most of his titles just mean like,
look at me,
I'm the boss. Yeah, exactly.
Literally,
you know,
five Minguses.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like I kind of wish that we were getting paid just to say his name, because I think by his design, we've wound up saying it quite a bit. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just really loved this album. It was adventurous and fascinating and off the beaten path for music, certainly, but even for jazz, which is, you know, kind of a world unto itself now, unfortunately. People don't, the common person, I don't think, has as much of an awareness as jazz, but I feel like people are missing out. Listener, if you don't listen to jazz, go out and check out, like, look up records from 1959 and start there, and you can move backwards and forwards in time, and you'll have kind of a good understanding of, like, where jazz is going and where it's come from.
Absolutely, man. I agree. I think it's definitely something I've missed out on for a long time. And between Herbie Hancock 3 or 4 weeks ago and then this album this week, it's kind of turned on this light of something I've been missing in my personal lexicon of music. So if anything, you've opened my eyes to something I've missed. So I think that's a good place to leave it when it comes to talking about this one.
All right. Well, good deal. If you need any recommendations, I got you. I'll hook you up. I can hook you up with, if you want to get weirder, we can get weirder. If you want something a little bit more accessible, I know some musicians to throw your way. So anywho, we could go on to the critical reception, but there wasn't much for it. It's, we've fallen victim again to the, this album came out before the internet.
That is so true. I did want to take this time in our show, though, and I didn't put it in the notes, to talk about some of the awards and honors that Mingus has earned, both in his lifetime and then, you know, after he passed away. In 1971, he got the Guggenheim Fellowship, which is a pretty big deal.
Oh, wow.
And then in 1971, he was also inducted into the Jazz Hall of Fame. In 1988, the National Endowment for the Arts provided grants for a Mingus nonprofit called Let My Children Hear Music, which cataloged all of his works. And the microfilms of those works were given to the music division of the New York Public Library, where they are currently available for study.
Oh, wow.
That was followed in 1993 by the Library of Congress acquiring all of his collected papers, including the scores for this recording, his sound recordings, his correspondence, his photos, and they are described as the most important acquisition of a manuscript collection related to jazz music in the Library of Congress's history. He's had numerous stamps with his face on them from the USPS, posthumously. He was awarded the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, and he was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. And then finally, in 2005, he was inducted into the Jazz at the Lincoln Center Hall of Fame. So the guy is regarded, despite his personality, for his contributions to music, and I think he should be applauded for it, even if there weren't reviews that we could just point to on this album.
Yeah, I would love to get my hands on like a copy of some of those scores, because it's always interesting and exciting to look at, you know, before, in a time before music notation software, it would have been in his own kind of unique music handwriting.
Yeah.
And that's always like super exciting and interesting.
Well, that was one of the things I liked about that Epitaph concert. They were talking about the original failed recording in 63 when he was kicking people out of the theater. It was while most of the band was still copying down the music. So he didn't even show up with music for everybody. They were copying it down off of. So,
oh, goodness.
Oh, to have 1959 problems.
Yeah.
No Xerox for you.
Next time I am unprepared for something, I'm going to think of that and go, hey, it could be a whole lot worse.
Yeah, my producer could have sold this as a concert instead of a studio recording practice session.
And talking about somebody getting canned as soon as humanly possible. Well, do you want to give a review to this thing?
Yeah.
So just as a reminder to our listeners, before we get started with the reviews, we rate our albums on a 1 to 6 string scale. 1 string being a terrible album, we would never listen to it again. 6 strings being a magnum opus that we would put on and weep tears of exultant joy, or something to that effect. So Wood, why don't you give us your take on Mingus Ah-Um?
First off, we didn't talk about it too much during this recording, but Charles Mingus kind of has my love from the first time I saw a picture of him, because just about every Google image is of him with a cigar in his mouth playing a 4-string bass. And so I'm going to stray from the normal rules. I'm going to say I'm rating this on 4-string and 2-cigar basis. So
yes, I love it.
Anyhow, let's talk about this album for a moment. The last time we did a jazz album, which was Herbie Hancock's Headhunters, I admitted that I was a total jazz newbie. I don't know the first thing about jazz music other than it's improvisational and it's the music that makes, you know, New Orleans so great and much of, you know, the uniquely American aesthetic of, you know, the mid-20th century. So indelible in our cultural milieu, or whatever word you want to use for it. I have a very limited experience with the genre regardless. And I think these two albums have been a really cool way to introduce me to what jazz music is and what it can be. And in the case of this album, what it was before and where he was trying to steer it to. I obviously have a huge hole in my musical lexicon that I need to go find a way to fill up now that I've had a little bit more experience with it and talked with you throughout time. I remember when you were in jazz band and when we were talking about that, and it just never really connected with me. And hearing Charles Mingus's music this week really kind of turned me on to certain aspects of it that I really found that I enjoyed. I'm officially aboard the jazz train at this point, and it's going to be one of those things that I'm going to try and search out and enjoy. I will admit, when I was younger, and maybe even more recently than just younger, but, you know, I kind of thought of jazz music as, you know, background music that played at a bar, or even worse, what I had to listen to while we were on hold waiting for something to happen. And it's so much more than that. I didn't feel like this album had me on hold the whole time. It had me hooked. I wanted to listen to it. And those first three tracks, the way this was organized, those first three tracks really grabbed you and held you in place. And it let you, you know, it anchored the experience as you got into some of the more, challenging or innovative tracks that were uncomfortable ground for me. And then getting the experience of tying it back to things that I was familiar with was really helpful throughout the week. I think with that said, I have a hard time finding anything that I distinctly find as a fault with this recording or with this album. There are things that I wasn't necessarily comfortable with, but I think that that's what jazz music must be about, is exploring feelings in a way that may not be comfortable for everybody all the time. And I love how charismatic Charles Mingus is with his instruments. So, with that said, I'm going to give him all 4 strings on the upright bass and 1 cigar, which roughly translates into 5 out of 6.
Great. Man, that cigar sounds good right about now. So, for me...
Oh, that cigar is definitely a Monte Cristo. It's not some cheap crap. It's the cigar.
Yes. Yeah, I can't imagine Charles Mingus being the kind of guy who would stop by CVS to buy like a Swisher Sweet or something. But man, okay, so for me, this is jazz at its most compelling. I feel like there's something new around every corner of this album. It's really a distillation of Mingus's character, you know, as much as I can possibly know about him from reading about him anyway. There are these bright, sunny hilltop moments, their deep, dark corners, their explosions of anger. It's got all these familiar elements of jazz. It swings and it's driving. But there are also moments where he pushes the envelope, and it seems like he's just trying to test the limits of the conventions of the art form that he works in. I was a fan of this album when I first heard it. But now, like, kind of getting into it more, I'm just only more bought into it. This isn't jazz is different than what we listen to in our everyday lives at this point. It's definitely out of the cultural lexicon in some ways. So I'm not about to throw Mingus on the record player for a party, but it is alluring. It's obtuse. It's strange. It's familiar. It's totally weird. I love it. And so at the risk of inflating the currency, so to speak, I have to give Mingus a 6 out of 6 string rating.
Very good, Chris. I feel like you give albums that are on your list much higher ratings than you give albums on my list, and I'm going to prove you statistically wrong.
I bet you can, because I was thinking about that today. I was like, I wonder how many of my own albums I give like really high ratings. That's probably not a good thing. Meanwhile, I throw you all these like weird, difficult curveballs where it's like, try and enjoy this week. Good luck.
There have been a couple of those conversations with Tiffany where I'm like, how does he enjoy this, let alone me?
Does he expect me to enjoy this? I hope not.
Are you okay? Oh, no. Like, I saw you added a Jonas Brothers album to the list.
No, sir. That is a bridge too far.
Speaking of the list, I think it's time we talk about our least and favorite track before we get to the Oracle. What was your favorite and least favorite?
So my favorite track is one we didn't talk about too much. It's the tune Fables of Phobos. This is one of them that I am almost positive I heard on 91.7. And for one thing, the music is delightful. Mm-hmm. This is a song that I get stuck in my head a lot. You know, it's got that kind of cloying, like, da, 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 da. You know, it's just so... so catchy. But what I didn't know about it is it actually, for one thing, it has words that the record company was like afraid to allow on the track. And so they were left off and then re-released with the vocals, you know, by some other label that was a little bit more willing to embrace the lyrical content. But the song is kind of a dig at Orville Faubus, who was the governor at the time of Arkansas. Schools were being integrated, and Faubus refused and brought in the Arkansas National Guard to prevent the integration of Little Rock Central High School. And it got as high up in like litigation or whatever you want to call it as the president. Mm-hmm. President Eisenhower had to step in and interfere to get the black students some protection and enforce the integration. And so I like the political bent of the song. You know, it's got this kind of weird plotting hook, which I kind of interpret as a caricature of Faubus and his backward views. And the song is interesting to me musically because it kind of alternates between like some really hip kind of swung phrases. And then this lurching drum groove. I was listening to a podcast earlier this morning, and one of the hosts described it as sounding like an indicator light from a car, because he's got those little like rim shots on the snare or whatever they are. And so that song has just a ton of character. And you also get to hear Mingus play bass on it. He has a little section of improvisation, which I like. So that was mine. What was yours?
So we landed so far apart this week. My favorite track is Fables of Phobos as well. I did not know any of the history behind or the underlying story behind the song. I just was drawn to the musicality of the song. And in my show notes, which I wrote on my phone the other day, I felt like what I loved about the song, and I don't use the word love lightly, like I really liked this song for its bass line that Mingus is playing throughout. It is really catchy, and the brass just is perfect throughout. And in quotations here, I have, it almost has a Pink Panther kind of vibe to it.
Absolutely. And I'm now, so glad you said that.
And now knowing that it has to do with, you know, Orville Faubus and his, you know, integration blocking reforms, it makes him out to be a bumbling idiot, which is what Jacques Clouseau is like to the core. Yeah.
So it fits so perfectly.
It's like, all right, I get this. Like, that's accessible. So
man, that's so funny.
So I loved that track. I think it's a phenomenal track, and it stands on its own as probably being the best track on the album for me personally.
Yeah.
What was your least favorite track?
So I've been trying not to do this, but I had to cop out and just say, I didn't really have a least favorite song. For me, all of it kind of fit together as a real coherent piece. And I'm probably not being very, very objective.
You suck at podcasting.
I know. It's terrible. Okay. Put a gun to my head. Let me look at the track list real quick and give this thing an honest shot here.
He's not going to change his mind, folks.
No, I will. If you're going to make me find one, I'll find one. I got to find it in my Apple Music stuff and things.
While you're doing that, I'll talk about my least favorite.
Thank you. Please rescue me from this dead space.
Like I said, your podcasting skills. Come on, man.
Oh, man, they're taking a nosedive.
So my least favorite track on this album was actually really easy for me to pick. I knew it was my least favorite the first time I heard it, and that's Bird Calls. And I understand.
Oh, man.
I understand that it's probably the craziest track on the album, and it's doing a whole lot of stuff trying to impersonate actual native bird calls, and it's all over the place melodically. It is the most improvisational and experimental of the tracks on this album. But to me, after a couple of times of listening to it, it became the track that I just skipped because it was so not based in any sort of like musical structure I'm familiar with or comfortable with.
Yeah.
And for me, it came across as being frantic for the sake of being frantic, not because it had any sort of place to go with that.
Yeah. You know,
I'm late for an important date kind of thing. And so it just, it's the one track that if I could have cut it from this album, I probably would have given this album 6 out of 6, honestly.
Yeah. Interesting. So this album kind of went through a few permutations. The original Columbia Records release, all these tracks were about half their length.
Mm-hmm.
Like Better Get It In Your Soul was full length, but Bird Calls, for an example, was only 3 minutes and 12 seconds. Compared to the 6 minutes and 17 seconds that it is.
There you go.
I kind of wonder if you would have been more okay with it if it had been real short. Who knows? If I had to pick one, gun to my head, it would probably be Girl of My Dreams. That was on it was a bonus track on the version of this album I listened to. And it's the only tune not composed by Mingus. And I don't remember anything about it.
I thought we weren't doing extended plays. What the heck?
You
still weaseled that.
You're right. Okay. No. All right. So second try here.
Apparently we're playing Russian roulette and the gun isn't loaded.
I know it. So Pussycat Dudes was probably the other tune that was a little bit forgettable, almost because it was like super mainstream. Not to be an insufferable hipster about it, but it was actually like just fairly traditional jazz tune. So if you're going to make me pick, I'm going to pick Pussycat Deuce.
This is probably going to come back and bite me in the future. Now that I've held you to the fire over this, you're going to make
Well, it's tough. That's what makes bonus tracks so irritating, is because sometimes they seem like they fit in. Like with this album, I listened to the whole thing straight through. And only afterwards I realized, like, oh, those were bonus tracks. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just going to incorporate them into the album in my head or whatever.
Gotcha.
But there are some times where it's like, this is a bonus track that's like the third take that we did that doesn't sound very good. And, you know,
this track got cut because it sucks, but we're going to give it to you for free anyway.
That's one of the seven deadly sins, but we made it to the end of this thing. Why don't we consult the Oracle and see what she's got in store for us next week?
Absolutely, Chris. So this week we're picking from my list, which is down to 29 albums at the moment. So pretty good odds of getting something that I consider is amazing. And let's see if I can hit the right button and see what she gives us. Number six, we're going back to our roots, Chris. We are playing Marty Robbins' 1959 album, Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs.
I am so excited.
We're staying in 1959 for one of the greatest country albums ever recorded.
Oh, that his music is delightful, and I am pleased as punch, as they say. That is going to be great. I'm going to show up with a big iron on my hip. We're going to do some shooting.
That's awesome. All right, man. I was supposed to have the witty ending for this show. What the heck?
Oh, shoot. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to steal your thunder. I haven't played Fallout New Vegas in forever, but that is that song is always going to be stuck in my head because of that game. But anyway. Okay, well, folks, thank you so much for listening. If you have been enjoying our show, please rate it and review it. It really helps us kind of get seen on Apple Podcasts and all the other podcatchers of choice. And remember, if you comment or send us an email or whatever, we might even read your review or comment on air.
Absolutely, Chris. And if you want to get in touch with us, shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com. And don't forget to hit us up on Instagram or Facebook. Chris keeps us pretty active over there. Tell us what you thought of Mingus A'um. And don't forget to tune in next Wednesday when we ride into El Paso and meet Felina at Rosa's Cantina.